Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Corey Shockey, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, former deputy director of policy planning staff in the State Department, and your moderator for today's program. It is now my distinct pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Dr. Henry Now, professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, former member of President Ronald Reagan's National Security Council, author of the new book that he's going to discuss with us tonight, Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. And I'd like to say that Henry Now is almost unique in our field in that his work combines technology, economics, values, and the historical trends and schools of thought in American foreign policy. He did his undergraduate work at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, his graduate work at Johns Hopkins University, is the author of a number of superb books, which I commend to your judgment, and he is also a veteran, having served in the Army back in his youth. Please join me in welcoming Professor Henry Now.
Thank you so much, Corey. It's a real honor to be here and a special honor to be introduced by Corey. I got to know Corey a little better a couple of years ago when I spent a year at the Hoover Institution. And I can remember well one day when she took me out to a welcoming lunch and we had a nice lunch, and then she dragged me with her to a bookstore, an old bookstore in Palo Alto. There aren't that many of those old bookstores with ladders and so on anymore, but there was then. And she was looking for an obscure book by an obscure Greek philosopher that she was going to take with her, not obscure at least to me, that she was going to take with her on a solitary trek to Death Valley. So I thought to myself, well, gosh, that's that's what makes scholars interesting and, you know, unique. But little did I know that she did this sort of thing with a real human touch, because when she got back from, it was Death Valley, wasn't it? Or it was close anyway. My geography out here is not that great. She calls me up one day and she said, I had talked to her, I had agonized about whether I should buy a bicycle while I was in California, or whether I should have my car shipped out from Washington, or whether I should buy a car. And so I'd been agonizing about that. She remembered that. She calls me up and she says, Henry, I got a bicycle for you. I thought to myself, oh, boy, she goes to the top of my list as a friend, as a scholarly friend with a humane touch. So I spent 10 months with that bicycle, and I really had a California experience. I learned what it was like to get everything done on a bicycle. Well, let me begin maybe with a very stark prediction, perhaps to get your attention. I think that America today, and when I say America, I mean you and I, is making a terrible mistake. It's going to cost us dearly in treasure and blood in the not-too-distant future. Now, what do I mean? Well, I think we are repeating an historic pattern of overreach in international affairs, where we go out and try to do too much, followed by an equally vigorous effort to retreat from the international system, or to pare our responsibilities back in the international system. 2 years ago, the American people voted, or I'm sorry, 10 years ago, the American people voted overwhelmingly to go to war in Afghanistan and in Iraq. By the way, the congressional debate vote was quite substantial, more substantial in the war in 2003 than it was in 1991, when we had UN authorization to go to war in 1991. Today, the same American people, you and I, are voting overwhelmingly to come home and never to put boots on the ground again in Syria or anywhere else. Now, this pattern has occurred repeatedly after World War I, after World War II, after Korea, after Vietnam, and now after Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you think about those historical periods or episodes, every time within 10 years, the world hit us again, or within 10 or 20 years, the world hit us again and we found ourselves back into the world. under circumstances, by the way, that were much more dire than when we left the world. After World War I, of course, we experienced Pearl Harbor. After World War II, we turned the world over to the UN, came the Berlin Crisis of 48 and the Cold War. After Korea, we had a tendency to pull back in the late 50s, mid and late 50s, downsize our responsibilities. What happened? The Cuban Missile Crisis. And after Iraq and Afghanistan, after Vietnam, we experienced the same kind of attack on the United States in the case of the Iranian hostages, and, of course, the aggressiveness on the part of the Soviet Union, especially in Afghanistan. Now, something like that, unfortunately, I think is going to happen again this time around. We will pull back and we'll ignore gathering storms abroad until something worse happens and we are attacked again. That possibility, by the way, is taking shape right at this very moment in the northeastern part of Syria, where Al-Qaeda forces now are, in fact, controlling territory again, the way the Taliban government controlled territory in Afghanistan, and they're training terrorists by the dozens, if not by the tens of dozens, and these people are going to be out there in the world and undoubtedly striking us at some point in the future, or our friends in Europe. Now, why do we do this over and over again? Well, I think we do it, I argue, because we have only two main traditions for thinking about American foreign policy, and this inspired my effort to try to think about an alternative to those two traditions. We have what we call a realist nationalist tradition, all right, in our study of American foreign policy and our experience over the years. And that tradition worries about trying to keep the costs of our involvement in the world down. And it does so primarily by limiting our objectives. It says that we ought to be most concerned about our defense, maybe just the defense of our borders, possibly the defense of this hemisphere. Nationalists tend to take that view. In other words, be very limited in what you expect to accomplish and just defend yourself. Realists take a little bit more of an expansive view. They want us to be a little concerned about what's going on elsewhere in the world, because if a great power were to emerge in some other part of the world, then they might interfere in this hemisphere. So maybe we need to be out there balancing power in Asia and in Europe. But generally speaking, this tradition, or these two traditions, the nationalist and the realist tradition, urge us to be restrained in world affairs and to keep our focus primarily on America's defense. Keep our costs down. Don't expect to accomplish very much. You're just preserving a world that exists. You're preserving the status quo. You're not making things any better in the world, and you shouldn't necessarily try to make things better in the world. That's when you will incur costs that cannot be sustained. Now, the second tradition is a liberal internationalist tradition, which almost flips that around, and it says we ought to have very, very ambitious goals in international affairs, and you know what? It's not going to cost us very much to achieve them. We'll be able to do most of these things through international institutions, through diplomacy, through trade, through interdependence, through negotiations, and we won't have to involve ourselves that much in the balance of power. In fact, over time, we can replace the balance of power with problem solving through common institutions. Now, this tradition throws us deeply into the world, causes us to dive deeply into the world, but misleads us, I think, in terms of thinking that we can achieve these objectives, transforming the world, spreading freedom, removing the balance of power from the interactions in international affairs. It misleads us in thinking we can do all that at no cost, and certainly at no military cost. Now, these two traditions, I argue, yank us back and forth in world affairs. All right? The liberal internationalist tradition causes us to dive in. We can do all these things. It won't cost us that much. Of course, we eventually find out it does cost us a lot, and sure enough, then we pull back. And this is exactly the mood that we're in today. We're going to pull back. We're going to trim our objectives. We're going to really just take care of America. I just heard Representative Ron Paul on television last night, and that was his view about almost any problem that was brought up, Syria, Ukraine. Just let them take care of it. Stay home. Stay out of their business, and they'll stay out of our business. That's a good, strong, you know, nationalist and sometimes also realist sort of admonition. Now, I think we need something in between. I think we need to recognize that we probably have to stay engaged. We have to be involved in the world for something more than just to preserve the world the way it is. All right, I'm going to argue that. And if we want to try to change the world in some way, however modestly, it's going to cost us something. All right, but we need to find a way that we can make those costs acceptable over the long run to the American people. All right, so that we don't overburden the American people for short periods, short bursts of activity in international affairs, like we've done for the last 10 years, and then put them in the mood, as they are today, for example, where they do not want to do anything more in the world until, of course, somebody at some point, again, attacks us. And that third alternative I call conservative internationalism. Now, what it does is it takes pieces of these other traditions, all right, and tries to put them together in sort of a intermediate approach that would give us worthy objectives at acceptable cost and keep us involved in world affairs on a sustained basis. It would take the objectives of liberal internationalism, which is to spread freedom, make the world a better place, hopefully bring prosperity and liberty to more and more people in the world, all right? Unlike realism, which doesn't want to do that. You know, the realists don't want to spread freedom. They want to just defend the status quo. So it would take that desire on the part of liberal internationalists to spread freedom, but it would use the instruments of realism to achieve it. It would recognize that you're going to have to, at some point, use military power in various ways if you're going to be serious about making the world a better place. The world's simply not going to change dramatically at low cost, and certainly despots are not going to go away without a struggle, and they are the ones, in some sense, that are going to resist any effort to try to transform the system, certainly any effort to try to spread freedom. All right, but you do all of this, you pursue freedom now with a more realistic sort of application of military power, but you do it all for a more modest world, like the nationalists envision. That is, you do it for a world of decentralized states. We don't have to build these grand international institutions and eventually surrender our sovereignty to these international institutions. We can live in a world in which countries remain countries and remain separate, but increasingly become democratic, increasingly become more pluralist, and therefore live side by side in peace, as we have learned in the case of democratic peace studies, because studies in my field of political science have shown that countries, in fact, that are more liberal, more pluralist, live in greater peace with one another. They don't go to war with each other. So we could envision, in other words, a world like the nationalist sees, which is, you know, the last thing the nationalist wants to do is give up national sovereignty. Well, you don't have to give up national sovereignty. You could have a world in which countries are independent and separate, but increasingly pluralist and democratic, and therefore live in peace with one another. Now, let me just quickly sort of outline five parts of this new approach, or this alternative approach of comparative of conservative internationalism, and maybe give you an example or two from the presidents I study, whose policies I think maybe best represent this approach in thinking about American foreign policy. Those presidents are Thomas Jefferson, James Polk, Harry Truman, and Ronald Reagan. First, what do I mean by conservative? That will distinguish, of course, conservative internationalism from liberal internationalism. Secondly, what do I mean by internationalism? Because that's a big distinction from nationalism. Third, what do I mean by armed diplomacy? That's the subtitle of the book. What do I mean by the use of military power? Well, Professor, now what are you talking about? That's what gets us into trouble. All right, I want to tell you why. I think we have to arm our diplomacy. We don't have a choice, really, given the nature of the world in which we live. Fourth, how does conservative international then use armed diplomacy to spread freedom without overburdening the American people, without causing the kinds of excessive costs that we see that we've incurred over the last 10 years? In other words, how do you set priorities in this approach? And fifth, how does conservative internationalism not only always arm diplomacy, that is, you never make a diplomatic initiative without backing it up with force, but you also never use force without backing it up with a diplomatic initiative? That is, the purpose of using force is to increase your leverage in negotiations. And therefore, at some point, you want to cash in that leverage in order to achieve a compromise that moves the negotiations in your direction. But you're not trying to defeat an adversary in some conventional sense. You're trying to incrementally move the relationships between between free and unfree countries towards greater freedom, but in an incremental fashion. Now, first point, what do I mean by conservative? It's a bit confusing because in one sense, all Americans are liberals. That is, we're all classical liberals. We all believe in individual liberty and equality as the basis of political authority. There's not many of us who believe in the authority of the crown, the monarch, the church, the pope, or indeed even of the central state as the basis for political life. Right? So for this reason, by the way, in contrast to Europe, the United States has no confessional or religious parties on the right, as Europe does, nor do we have any radical or socialist and communist parties on the left, as Europe has had. That's worth remembering, by the way, especially when we bemoan polarization in this country. Our parties are not that far apart on most issues. By the way, President Obama himself has acknowledged that, and especially if you put it in this historical context. American politics plays out in the center, essentially, of the political spectrum, not on the fringes, as has happened for hundreds of years, or at least for a couple of hundred years, in Europe. But conservatives and liberals in America differ in two very important ways. First, American conservatives are more committed to individualism than to equality. They are what I call classical liberals. Right? They've remained classical liberals. They tend to see government as a greater threat to liberty than the market or private sector. They therefore seek to limit the government's role, even if that means at times greater social inequality in the private sector. Now, American liberals are more committed to equality than to liberty. They are what I call social liberals, not classical liberals, but social liberals. They tend to see the market or private sector as a greater threat to freedom than the government. They therefore seek activist government in order to root out discrimination in the private sector, even if a growing government sector means at times greater restrictions on personal freedom. Secondly, conservatives and liberals differ in the relative emphasis that they place on the role of tradition and reason in human affairs. Right? Conservatives are more skeptical about the nature of human life and human society. They see human beings as flawed, and they doubt that you can perfect government or human society primarily by rational planning and policy making. Conservatives see a greater role for tradition, religion, and virtue in making decisions about human affairs. Liberals, by contrast, are more optimistic or positivist about American nature and knowledge. They believe that science and expertise can improve, maybe even perfect, human nature and society over time. They are more secular than religious. For liberals, the study of society is ultimately objective, just like nature, like the study of nature. Social issues can be solved objectively, as they are in the case of science. For conservatives, the study of society can never be wholly objective because we are studying ourselves. When we study society, we are studying things we like and dislike, some political parties, labor unions, corporations. When physicists study the universe, they aren't studying things that they necessarily like or dislike. They don't like or dislike quarks or planets. So you can never be as objective in social science as you can be in natural science, according to conservatives. Now, these views affect foreign policy in very significant ways. All right? Because of their commitment to individualism and limited government, conservatives do not support central international institutions abroad any more than they do at home. So they're not big fans of the United Nations and other international institutions, not because helicopters, UN helicopters, are about to take over, but because they represent sort of centralized government that may not be accountable to the people. It's centralized government, in fact, that's going to be several levels removed from accountability to the people, since nobody gets elected in international institutions that I know of. Now, conservatives prefer federalism and very loose associations, all right, overseas as well as at home. Thomas Jefferson had the first conception of this sort of view. He talked about sister republics in this continent, on this continent. When he acquired the Louisiana Purchase, he said, well, we may create states there, and they may want to become part of the United States, but they may not, and that's okay. They can live side by side as sister republics and remain independent. Now, secondly, because of their skepticism and their commitment to tradition, religion, and virtue, conservatives do not think that the advance of liberty is just a matter of time, something that's going to happen automatically as science and modernization progress and slowly develop other societies and liberalize other people. Conservatives are going to be less sanguine about these prospects. And they tend to see the development of liberty in the world not as a function of modernization, but as a function of moral struggle. You have to get out there and you have to actually confront the moral issues that are, for example, taking place right today on the streets of Ukraine, or the moral issues that were at stake in some of our great struggles, for example, the Civil War. And these things could swing one way or the other. There's no guarantee they're going to always go in the direction of progress. Now, Jefferson was a great example, I think, of both of these kinds of commitments. He clearly put self-government and liberty first in all of his thinking. He had a wonderful saying, which I refer to all the time, and by the way, Ronald Reagan referred to it all the time. He actually quoted it in a letter to Brezhnev at one point. He said this in his inaugural address, as Jefferson did. He said, sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others? There was Jefferson's concept of you better have good people and good individuals, otherwise you're not going to have a very good society, and you're certainly not going to have a good government. Secondly, he was more committed to politics than he was to reason, even though he was a man of reason, by the way. He was a Renaissance man. But he believed that you had to argue issues out in the public square, that experts didn't have a particular edge in that debate. They had to make their case in the public square like everyone else. And he had another wonderful way of expressing this in his inaugural address. If there be any among us, he said, who would wish to dissolve this union or change its republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments to the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. I mean, there is a statement about American politics which we ought to, I think, if you're a conservative, you resonate to. In other words, we get out there in the public square and we argue. Jefferson, at another point, said, too, he said, a minority has only one right, and that is to become a majority. You don't have a right to withdraw. You don't have a right to block. You have a right to become a majority. That's it. Now, you've got to have free and fair elections and open media and all those sorts of things in order to have a fair chance. But Jefferson, I think, was quite remarkable. He, by the way, solved one of the most... really one of the worst cases of government abuse in the history of our country, and he did it through politics. I'm talking about the Alien and Sedition Acts. When the Federalist government passed legislation that put 300 of Jefferson's supporters in jail, not a one Federalist journalist or supporter, only Jefferson's supporters. Well, he could have really been furious. Can you imagine if somebody did that today? Well, Jefferson opposed it, obviously, but then he said, well, take it to the American people. We'll have an election. And he looked at he saw the elections of 1800 and then 1804 as having dealt with the issue. He never took it to courts. He never took it to the Supreme Court or anything else. He said, nope, this isn't an issue for the courts. It's an issue for the public square. He lived sort of this conservative idea appealing to discussion and debate rather than to science or to expertise. Now, what do I mean by internationalist? Well, that's a big divide between nationalists and internationalists. Nationalists say, worry only about security, your defense. Internationalists say, nope, worry about freedom, and not only your freedom, but freedom in the world. Worry about improving the conditions in the world. There may be, and by the way, that is a big divide. It, every time I go to one of the institutions in Washington, this is a big debate. How much should we be concerned about freedom in the world? Or how much should we, is that any of our business to think of Ron Paul and his, this is the father, by the way, I'm speaking about, not Rand, but Ron Paul. Well, look, there may be a third possibility here. And I think Ronald Reagan, to some extent, exemplified that. He believed that America was a place that needed to be defended, but he also believed that America was an idea that that transcended national boundaries. So he believed that you had to defend America because America, in some sense, was a bastion of freedom. And he once said, if you lose it in America, where do we go? On the other hand, he believed that America was an idea that brought peoples from all the other parts of the world to America to live in a free society, a free republic. And therefore, in that sense, America was an idea that reflected the world. So how can we be indifferent to what is going on in the world when we are, in fact, the world? And if people come here from all creeds and cultures and accept democracy, why can't they accept it back home? Well, you say, we might say, well, because they've come here. But that must mean there's still a lot of people back there in Japan and in other countries that also believe in freedom. I happened to be in Japan just last month, and that's one of the questions I asked a couple of Japanese friends. I wanted to know more about liberalism in Japan. Where are your liberal traditions? Go back, and they actually were a little stunned by the question. But I said, just in your own cultures, find the patterns that represent a greater concern for individual liberty and individual freedom and individual equality. Well, Reagan combined these two. And frankly, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that when we care about our own freedom and don't care about the freedom in the world, we go wrong. Or vice versa, when we care about the freedom in the world and don't care about our own freedom. When we care about both, we achieve significant success. That was, by the way, right after World War II, where we fought the battle in the world for freedom against communism, and we made more progress on civil rights in our own society than we ever did before. So it is possible to think of a third alternative in which we don't draw a sharp distinction between a country that's a place to defend and an idea that we export abroad. In fact, we are both. And we need to be engaged. Reagan was very clear about the fact that we had to be involved in the moral arguments that were going on overseas. He really objected to the moral equivalence, you know, of saying that the Soviet Union was just protecting itself like we were, and they were no worse and no better than we, that we were all doing the same things. He really objected to that. He said there was a moral issue here, and we better be involved in it. All right? But now we encounter a problem, and here's my third point. If we care about freedom, and we are going to be serious about it in the world, we're going to confront despots who are not going to agree with us and who are going to oppose us. And they are going to be more likely to use force in their reactions to our efforts to try to make the world a better place through freedom. They use force daily in their own societies. So they're going to be more likely to use force in their relationships with us. Reagan used to always comment, I heard him say this three or four times, that if they treat their own people that way, think how they might treat us if they get the chance. So there was an idea that we are confronting societies that congenitally use force. If we're going to be serious in dealing with them, we're going to have to confront them. We're going to have to arm our diplomacy. All right? If they know, for example, that we're not going to use force until after negotiations fail, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to negotiate with us forever, because that way we'll never use force. And now outside the negotiations, they're going to use force to achieve their objectives. You could almost say that's the picture of what's going on today in the Middle East. That's the picture of what's going on today in Iran. Iran is negotiating. Oh, they'll negotiate for as long as we want to negotiate, as long as they can. But outside the negotiation, because they know then that we won't use force until the negotiations fail. But outside the negotiations, what are they doing? They're moving willy-nilly towards the acquisition of nuclear weapons. They're supporting the Assad regime in Syria. They're re-catalyzing, the Shiite movement in Iraq. They are forming a relationship with Russia to pressure Israel and the Persian Gulf states in the Middle East. They're using pressure and force to achieve their objectives. So we have to arm our diplomacy. Now, you do this in three ways. I won't go into the details. We can get into some of it in the discussion if you want. But you do this by what I call background leverage. That is, you build up defenses like Ronald Reagan did in order to make sure that your despotic adversary knows that they probably can't win an arms race outside of negotiations. Right? You let them know, in other words, you better take negotiations seriously because you're really not going to be able to achieve your objectives outside the negotiations. Right? You also then use force to push back whenever the adversary, the non-democratic adversary, whenever it tries to use force. For example, the pressure that Iran is exerting in Iraq now, supporting some of the Shiite militia in Iraq and so on. Well, if we had left a few ground forces in Iraq when we pulled out, that might have been some constraint on that. That might have offered some pushback. As it is, there is no pushback at this stage. So you need to be able to respond on the ground, leverage on the ground, as I call it, in order to block the despotic adversary, the non-democratic adversary, from achieving objectives on the ground. And thirdly, you need military leverage in negotiations in order to trade things off. Here, again, Reagan was very clear when he decided, when he was determined to deploy INF weapons to counter the SS-20s that the Soviets deployed already in the 1970s. He made it very clear in National Security Council meetings already in late 81 and early 82 that the Russians would never get serious until we deployed, because we were asking them to remove something that was real, and we had nothing in the field to reciprocate with. So they would never disarm until we had deployed the INF weapons. And, of course, he was right. Once we deployed the INF weapons, then the Soviets became serious about negotiating them, and eventually we eliminated them. That was the so-called, the famous zero-zero option. So you are going to have to use force. This is the reason why conservative international says, look, it's an illusion to think that you can get away in international affairs, especially against countries that are not democratic, without using force. All right? But now we've got a problem, right? Because if we're going to be more ambitious in terms of possibly changing the world, and we realize we're going to have to use force at times because our adversaries will use force, aren't we now pretty close to getting in trouble once again with overburdening the American people, that is, increasing the costs beyond what the American people can bear? And the answer is yes. And so two further points follow, very important points in a conservative internationalist approach. First, you set very clear priorities on where the spread of freedom is most important. It's not important everywhere in the world. It's most important on the borders of existing freedom. Right? I argue that that's a very important sort of premise that you have to establish. That is, the loss or the gain of freedom on the borders of existing freedom means a lot more than the loss or gain of freedom in some region of the world that is remote from the existing borders of freedom. Now, what do I mean by that? One existing border of freedom is Europe. All right. In fact, Ukraine, where all the explosions are going on today, that's right on the border between free countries in Europe and unfree countries in Russia, Belarus, and to the east. Turkey is on this border. In Asia, it's the border between Japan, South Korea, the United States, Taiwan, and China, and Mongolia. Another, Mongolia is not, you know, a Chinese ally, but North Korea. These borders are critical. And what happens, by the way, in Korea over the next 25 years, when some change takes place on that peninsula, it's bound to happen, is going to have more to say about the plight of freedom in Europe than anything, I mean, in Asia, than anything else. So these areas are extremely important. Now, they're important because if we lose freedom there, it comes closer to the core of freedom in our own part of the world, right? And they're important because we have the best chance of achieving success there, because we have these powerful free countries on one side, like the European Union, or like Japan and South Korea, and the Pacific, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we're trying to develop with Japan. We have these powerful markets and civil societies that can help us in that struggle. By the way, That's what enabled us to ultimately win the battle for freedom in Germany and Japan after World War II, right? Because there was a big battle for 40 years, and we won that battle. It was on the border of existing freedom. So we need to pay attention to those borders and not get distracted, as I would argue we have been in the last 10 years, and maybe also again in Vietnam earlier, and that is to think that we can build democracies in regions remote from the existing free countries. If you face a threat in those countries, like we did in Afghanistan, you obviously you have to go in and take care of the threat. But then my argument is you shouldn't stay. You should get out. Had we gotten out pretty quickly in the case of Afghanistan and maybe also Iraq, we probably would have left behind governments that are no worse than the ones we've left behind after 10 years, and we would have been out with manageable cost. And by the way, we might have been in a position to go back in if we need to in the future. So that's an extremely important constraint on conservative internationalism. And finally, the fifth point is that you've got to be ready to compromise. You have to be ready to follow any use of force with a diplomatic initiative. By the way, the president who was absolutely a genius at this was James Polk. I mean, we don't know a lot about James Polk, but he was remarkable. And you have to look at how he fought the Mexican War to understand how tightly he integrated force and diplomacy throughout, you know, that 2-year war. Four different times he made moves with one or the other, and he always backed it up, either with force if it was a diplomatic initiative or with diplomacy if it was a forceful initiative. And what did it do? It got us out of the Mexican War, by the way, with the original aims, nothing more. Remember, we occupied Mexico. We could have taken the whole country, all right? But we left. We compromised. We got out with just that which we had. Polk had made very clear from the beginning what he wanted. And 2 years later, even after a lot of bloodshed and so on, he settled for that. And American forces were out of Mexico in 6 months. Now, that was an extraordinarily important decision, I think. We could have had a long, long Ireland battle, in Ireland-type battle in Mexico if Polk had not been clear about that. And I sometimes wonder if that example had been in mind, had been in our minds, would it have made a difference in Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, would we have gotten out sooner, recognizing that that is, you know, that's the best way to handle these situations where the costs of staying for any length of time are so great? Well, look, let me stop there. I've gone on longer than I violated something which. A definition of intellectuals that Dwight Eisenhower once made, which I always thought was really great, and I've never been able to live up to it. He said, oh, well, you know, those are those guys who use a lot of words and spend a lot of time to tell you more than they know. So I've already done that. I think I'll stop and take your questions.
Well, this is... It's such a wonderful book, and I have questions of my own, but I have to tell you, we have gotten an avalanche of terrific questions from tonight's audience, both conceptual and challenging you to apply this framework to the contemporary problems that the good folks of the Commonwealth Club pay careful attention to. So I'm going to go straight to those, as a matter of fact, and let me read you the first question. It's not a question, it's a statement, but it's so charming. I expect you not to respond to it simply to blush, because that's the only appropriate answer to being told, as this member of our audience said, I believe that Reinhold Niebuhr has been reborn and appears in the speaker. Moral man and immoral society is one of my favorites. Thank you for ever offered that. And now your work begins, Henry.
Yeah, right.
Here's the first tough question. You mentioned that democratic countries are more likely to be at peace with one another. Is the cause of peace that they are democratic, or that they are culturally similar, or that they are economically well off, or under the U.S. security umbrella? I feel like this is a question that really engages all of the different elements of your expertise, Henry.
Yeah.
Take a swing.
Well, you know, we're still working on that. There's a lot of work on the democratic peace, the so-called democratic peace, and for maybe 40 years now, good political scientists have been working on this. And they continue to reach the conclusion that the evidence All right, over many, many cases now, because we have more democracies, and they have sort of fiddled with the definition of democracy in war to the point where they've been able to multiply the cases, that we have some pretty good statistical confirmation of the fact that democracies, countries that are democracies by some 35 or 40 different measures that which we have, all right, rather sophisticated measures, they do not militarize disputes. They don't even threaten each other with war, let alone go to war with one another. Now, we debate because social science can't, you know, has such difficulty tracing causality because it's so complex. So there are a lot of differences of views about whether this is due to economics and interdependence, whether it's due to the nature of democracy. You know, I always relied on a lot of, in many cases, on the work of Bruce Russett, who was a scholar of my generation at Yale University. And generally speaking, he continued to trace it back to the characteristic of the nature of democracies. They're open, they depend upon the people and the people's voice, and they have to approve war. They are the ones who have to pay the price, usually, of war. And that tends to be enough for them to be very cautious about war. They also can access each other's societies so that they have less fear of one another, because they can see that there's opposition to what, you know, if they don't like the government or the policy of the United States government, they know there's an opposition there that probably agrees with them, and that this is a very wholesome kind of, you know, development between democracies. So we're still working on it, but I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that it's as close, one colleague has said, as to a law in social sciences we have, namely that democracies do not go to war or militarize their disputes with one another.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dr. Henry Now, professor at George Washington University and former member of President Ronald Reagan's National Security Council, who's discussing how to improve America's foreign policy. Which takes us to the next great question from our audience. If we use force, other countries paint us as a bad cop, and they take the good cop image. What can we do about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, and it's time that that changed, because we have very strong allies who are able to afford more military capability and more military support. I liked very much what President Obama, for example, did in Libya, where he maneuvered the French and the British into the leadership of that effort in Libya. We need to do more of that. Now, that doesn't mean we abandon we stay out of it. We have to still, I think, be instrumental in maneuvering to get these countries to step up. But look, the long-run hope for the United States is that we at some point, as other countries become more powerful and we relatively become less powerful, that we pass the baton the way Britain passed the baton to us at the end of the 19th century, that we pass the baton to another, all right, democratic and like-minded power in the world. What would that power be? Well, it would be the European Union. Maybe somewhat later down the line, because I'm optimistic, more optimistic than some of my colleagues about Japan. But I think Japan is further has further to go. But the European Union is, you know, getting to the point where it can begin to step up if we were to maneuver as Obama did in subtle ways to let them know that we're there to provide assistance, but they're going to have to, or maybe to make our assistance contingent on their cooperation and on their leadership, much the way we did, by the way, with the Marshall Plan, where we said to the European countries, look, we'll give you aid, but you're going to have to figure out how to use it, and you're going to have to get together and come up with common plans on how to use it. And that was the spark, that was the origins of the common market.
Interesting to me that a man who wrote a book titled The Myth of America's Decline is actually also thinking about to what society or group of societies should we pass our leadership responsibilities. I hope we have time to come back to that, Henry, but I want to keep plowing through these great questions from our audience. The next one is, how would your framework apply to our relations with Iran?
Yeah. Well, I was going to give you an example on Syria, but I had already violated Eisenhower's admonition so badly, I let it go. But let me say, let me give it to you in the case of Syria, because it's actually easier to kind of see the difference. Your objective in the case of Syria would always be, if you were looking at this as a conservative internationalist, to weaken Assad. All right, not necessarily to uphold the chemical weapons ban. That would be something that you would do, that you would support more if you were looking at the problem from a liberal internationalist perspective. And by maybe giving too much emphasis to the chemical weapons ban, we've actually strengthened Assad. The purpose has to be ultimately to weaken Assad. That's a despicable, despotic regime. It has to be to weaken him. That's number one. Number two, you have to push back on the ground. That is, I think we made a mistake 2-3 years ago, and we're way behind the curve now, when we didn't decide who to arm among the opposition. So the opposition wasn't armed, and of course Assad was armed, and he has steadily made progress over the last couple of years. So you have to push back. If you don't push back early, you're going to wind up where we are now, where we're probably going to have to push back now. You know, the opposition is reforming in Syria, and the president looks like he's getting ready to start providing them with some arms. You're going to have to do it in greater measure. Had you done it 3 years ago, a smaller use of force would have sufficed to provide some pushback and some stalemate on the ground, because you have to stop Assad from achieving his objectives on the ground. Thirdly, and this is a very difficult part of this, but you've got to figure out a way, as long as Assad's there and you're negotiating with him, you got to figure out a way to, and you now are arming the opposition. Let's assume we move in that direction in the next few weeks. You need to, or next few months, you need to think about what you can offer to the Syrians and to Assad that they might accept, where you could cash in some of your military leverage. In other words, you have to think of some interim compromises along the way, which will ultimately weaken Assad. I'm thinking, for example, of how Reagan did this with Gorbachev. He offered Gorbachev things that Gorbachev eventually was interested in, like, you know, participation in the global economy, etc., all of which in the end was going to weaken the Soviet system, all right, certainly the communist system. But, you know, it was attractive to Gorbachev because the Soviets realized they... So I don't know what that would be. I'm not an expert on Syria, but you would try to find some things that you could, maybe some various kinds of assistance if you were able to get NGOs and other groups into Syria to disperse the assistance and so on. So you offer some ways to improve his situation, but always with the objective of getting some of your people, more of your people on the ground in his country, eventually in the long run, opening up that society and making it, you know, more difficult in the long run for him to maintain his position. The other thing you would do then, and this brings in Iran, is that you would remember that there are bigger issues in the Middle East than Syria. Iran is the bigger issue because it's the threatened hegemon in the region. Should it achieve its objective, along with, say, support from Russia, it would be a game changer in the Middle East. And the country that matters most in terms of the future of freedom in the Middle East is not Egypt. It's not Iraq. It's Turkey. And we have behaved in the Middle East in the last 10 years in ways that have actually weakened the cause of democracy in Turkey. So, again, and Turkey is important because of that, because it's on the border of existing freedom and therefore gets priority. So there are some real guidelines from this approach that can help you in even though it's not easy. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that it's easy.
Thank you. That's actually it's easy to see how those principles would likewise apply to the Iranian case. So I won't be too doctrinal in insisting on you answering that, especially since there are a lot of good questions yet to come.
I will say this. I mean, Obama's done a great job on sanctions in Iran, all right, because that has been pressure on Iran. But I think the mistake he made was in not emphasizing more his military arm. He hasn't paid enough attention to it. He hasn't paid enough attention to the defense budget. He hasn't outlined a defense strategy that has any prospect for, you know, holding our defense position over the course of the next 5-10 years. As I say, he's refrained from using any military force, either by leaving troops behind Iraq or by arming the opposition in Syria. So what's happened is that the Iranians have kind of looked at all this and they kind of know he's not going to use force. He's just never going to use force. And so that weakens the economic sanctions, right? Because at some point, the country will, I think, override the economic sanctions. They will be able to live through the economic sanctions. Now, by the way, we have relaxed the economic sanctions, and it's a question as to whether or not we've gotten anything concrete in return for that. But one thing for sure is I think the Iranians are pretty clear and almost, you know, I haven't heard, I mean, are pretty clear that Obama is not going to use force. He's not going to use force unless we're attacked, unless somebody attacks us.
The next question from our audience is that the situation between North Korea and South Korea is extremely tense right now. It seems as though conservative internationalism would mandate that the U.S. beef up its military pressure on North Korea. Would that aggravate tensions even further? Wouldn't that also make North Korea act more aggressively as it undermines their legitimacy? Yeah.
This is the eternal debate. All right, between great sort of, question. You could say, the conservative internationalists and the liberal internationalists, and it goes on all the time. If you use force in negotiations, don't you just provoke the adversary? And the conservative, that's what the liberal internationalist argues. And the conservative internationalist argues is you'll never get their attention unless you do. They'll just keep negotiating with you forever, and you'll never make any progress. Now, you know, you can find cases historically, I suppose, where you know, either point of view was apt at that particular moment. I do know this. Reagan was really challenged about his arms race, right? He really launched a massive arms buildup. And he was accused of provoking a new Cold War. And he was accused of making it much tougher for the Soviet Union to negotiate. He always insisted that I'm not doing this to win. I'm doing this to get them to the negotiating table. I want them to understand that if they do not negotiate, they are going to face a very formidable adversary, and they're not going to be able to compete with us. All right? SDI was, of course, you know, the leading edge of that. And, you know, it worked. Gorbachev tells the Politburo in October of 1985, 6 months after he comes into office, and we now have this record. He says to his colleagues, he says, you know, the last thing we can afford is an arms race with the United States. They will win, and we will lose. So there was, I mean, Reagan had done his, he had accomplished what he wanted to accomplish with his defense program without, by the way, having to use any defense capabilities. But he closed off that option, and that's the way the conservative internationalist thinks about it. There's always a risk to using force. But there's a bigger risk to waiting to use force. George Shultz has made that very clear in his writings. In other words, if you wait until you know, to use force as a last resort, it means you're going to have to use big force, because by that time, things have usually built up pretty badly. So using a little force early may save you from having to use a lot of force later. So this isn't a, you know, it's easy to try to sort of portray either one of these arguments as naive. You know, the one is the neocon argument, just beat them over the head with military weapons, and the other is, you know, the naive diplomatic idea that you can get anybody to agree just by being reasonable. Well, don't pay any attention to those stereotypes. There's a real difficult issue here in terms of how you and when you link force and diplomacy.
While we're on the subject of the use of military force, there are two other audience questions specifically on the use of military force, and I want to combine them and ask you to close out this part of our conversation that way. The one question is, how do you balance a finite American military force and protecting freedom abroad? Is this resolved by a greater military budget, prioritization of placement of military troops and power? And the second question is, what does conservative internationalism say about reconstruction after military intervention?
Well, I'll go backwards on that one, because I think it's important to address the question of nation building, which has been obviously in the news. I think I've made pretty clear that we ought to prioritize nation building on the borders of existing freedom. That is, when you do have a situation like we had after World War II, where you have countries on the border of existing freedom that are in that are destitute, you stick around to help them build their societies and rebuild their societies. We did that with Germany and Japan. That was nation building, by the way. It was very expensive. All right. It was also necessary because of the Soviet threat. I mean, there were all sorts of factors involved here, but it cost us a lot of money, but it worked. And the world today is much, much better off than probably has ever been, and certainly much better off than any world we've known because of it. Now, you don't prioritize nation building in Vietnam, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in these remote regions because you don't have the same capability going for you. And it doesn't mean as much, even if you succeeded. So watch out for, in other words, and maybe in the modern world, you know, you don't really want to fight wars to the end. That is, fight wars to unconditional surrender like we did in the case of World War II. Because when you do that, if you finally occupy Baghdad, you got to now build a country. You got to build, you're in, it's the Pottery Barn theory, you know, you now own it. You broke it, you now own it. So, you know, I think the objective here ought to be not to put as much emphasis on nation building as we have for the last 10 years, and especially in these remote regions, but to realize that in the case of a country like Ukraine and Turkey, I think we ought to be thinking nation building. I think we should be thinking about how to use the capabilities of the West, NATO, the European Union, and so on, in order to shore up the struggle going on. I don't mean to intervene, but I mean to balance this struggle and eventually give the advantage, hopefully, to the liberal forces in those countries. Defense, you know, it's a tough question. Corey, you know a little more about this than I do. What I think is the biggest failing, if I make a criticism of our government over the last 4 or 5 years, and maybe even under George W. Bush, is that we haven't really systematically had a debate and discussion and strategic sort of approach to our defense program now and in the future. We've kind of been reacting to one problem after the other, and of course to the situations particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm not sure that those situations, as I say, are really the major threats in the future. I mean, Ukraine, Turkey are much more important, and the Korean Peninsula. And in Asia, I'm really worried. I was just there last month because our two allies in Asia are at loggerheads with one another. They haven't made any progress since World War II in trying to bury the hatchet. I'm talking about South Korea and Japan. I mean, this is extraordinary. They're both, by the way, robust democracies, especially South Korea. They now have parties, you know, opposing parties that rotate in power, and free and open societies. But these two countries, for some reason, and here's where we have dropped the ball. I think by not focusing on where the battle for freedom is most important, we have lost sight of the fact that this is a huge gap and weakness in the future of freedom in Asia. If we don't repair that relationship, or that relationship between Japan and South Korea doesn't strengthen over time, we won't succeed in holding fast as we hope to bring China over decades closer and closer to the West through more and more internal liberalization. Eventually, we're going to invite China, by virtue of these differences between Japan and South Korea, to start playing off one country against the other. And we're in a mood, of course, to pull out of the region. You know, despite a pivot into the region, we actually are retreating to some extent in the region. And this is not a good formula, it seems to me, for the battle for freedom where it counts in Asia.
Our time is almost up. I'm going to ask one last question from our audience, because I think it's a terrific note on which to challenge you to end, Henry. Mm-hmm. It is, the GOP has still not recovered from the mistakes George W. Bush made in Iraq. Can the GOP ever recover? And what would you like to hear the 2016 GOP presidential nominee say about foreign policy? We have only about 2 minutes, my friend.
Right,
so good.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, I'm critical, obviously. Actually, I'm least critical of Ronald Reagan. You'll have to forgive that, since I worked with him, but I'm critical certainly of George W. Bush and President Obama. And I think mostly because, not because we were wrong about going into Afghanistan. We had to go into Afghanistan. They attacked us. That was a clear case of the terrorists trained under the Taliban government, knocked a couple of our buildings down, bombed our cities, in effect. You had to go in there and do it. Iraq, we had a big debate about it. We decided that they had weapons of mass destruction. Our intelligence agencies decided at that moment, with all the caveats and so on, that they had weapons of mass destruction. So did the intelligence agencies of the other major countries. So you could say that Iraq, too, was justified. I think where we made our mistake was not getting out. Going in, taking care of the threat, putting another government in place, and getting out. And, by the way, leveraging the military gains that we had made. George W. Bush didn't launch a Middle East peace initiative until 2007. I mean, his dad was a lot better in that respect. After the 91 war, he launched a Madrid peace initiative right away in the fall of 1991. I mean, we had a lot of leverage, even after having gone into Iraq without UN or even NATO approval. We still had a lot of leverage. That would have been the time for a diplomatic initiative. I think Polk would have had a diplomatic initiative going immediately. And maybe that would have facilitated, by the way, an earlier withdrawal on our part. And yes, we'd have left behind a weak government, but no weaker than the one we're leaving behind now.
Excellent. If I may, Henry, thank you for your terrific scholarship, for your public service as a senior policymaker on international economic policy, for the great example you have for us all as a scholar, and also for your service as a soldier back in your youth. You are yourself a Renaissance man, my friend. I hope you will join me in thanking Dr. Henry Now, professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, former member of Ronald Reagan's National Security Council, author of the new book, Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. I myself would not have thought he could make a persuasive case for Polk, and I think you'll have to admit he didn't do half badly. We also like to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We want to remind everyone that copies of Professor Now's new book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign them outside this room following the program. We appreciate your letting him make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Corey Shockey, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.